This is probably, maybe you'll continue next week, Vayishlach, but we're getting to the end of our conversations of Tefillah, Mirtz Hashem. As Hanukkah time comes, we'll use this slot to talk a little bit about Hanukkah. Next week, I'll talk a little bit about Chassidus, what Chassidus has done to Am Yisrael, because it's the lead up to Yud Tes Kislev. This is the month when a lot of people are thinking about Chassidus. So let's finish off our Tefillah, or get to the end of Tefillah. Vayifka b'makom vayalan sham kivah shemesh. I've spoken before, but I'll just make sure I reiterate it because I forgot how extensive I've been, that the word pegia means to change. And as much as tefillah is contemplative and internal and introspective, Hashem created a world in which we can change His will. And Chazal tell us that during the miracle of Purim, which we read with 20/20 hindsight as if the events were foregone conclusion, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu had decided in Shemayim to allow Haman's plans and conspiracies to actualize until Am Yisrael rallied with their tefillahs. And that is, HaKadosh Baruch Hu knew what would happen. It's foreknowledge. But had we not responded with tefillah, had we not taken that choice, then Am Yisrael would have been eliminated, or at least severely, severely annihilated. So sometimes I think, as I've spoken with you about before, you feel like you live in a predetermined world. And the world feels very heavy and very large, and you're not really able to change it. And obviously, I don't want you to feel that way. I want you to feel unlimited Bechira Chachis. We spoke about this last week. But also in your relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that there are issues in this world, and we try to solve them through our human effort, medically, politically, economically, emotionally, whatever tools we have. But you look to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is able to respond, not able, but is willing to respond to human tefillos and to change his needs. And Yaakov, who knows what Yaakov's ark would have looked like if he hadn't davened so vehemently on top of that mountain. Interestingly enough, the word pigia doesn't just mean to change. The word pigia means to change in a, I would say, pseudo-aggressive manner. I wouldn't say aggressive always. In the modern Hebrew, a pigua means a terror incident. Obviously, that's modern Hebrew. But does anyone know where else in Sefer Bereishis the word pigia is used in a similar context? Where else in the end of the parasha? So there, at least, doesn't sound like there's any aggression involved or any impact. He's just meeting them. But where else is it used in a way that, again, is not aggressive but assertive? Where? Not sure the word Pugua is mentioned. In Parshas Chevron, Parshas Chayisara, where Avram is trying to find who's the real person to speak to. Stop with all these negotiations. So he discovers that it's Ephron ben Sochar. So he says, Ufiguli, the Ephron ben Sochar. Now, why does he want to meet Ephron? To play some chess? To drink some whiskey and scotch? He wants to meet Ephron because he wants to change his mind. He wants to convince him. He wants to turn his opinion from resistant and hesitant to enthusiastic, and then he'll sell him the land. So he doesn't just want to meet him and talk to him, he wants to be assertive. Yeah, there's no aggression, there's no hostility, but he wants to change his mind. Another case in Tanakh, where you see the word lifgoa, I mean changing your mind, in a way that's assertive. Again, not aggressive, but what does Ruth tell Naomi when she says, I'm coming back with you, stop trying to dissuade me from returning with you to the land of Eretz Canaan. Al-Tifki-Ibi. Stop it. Stop trying to be pogay on me. Stop trying to change my mind. I'm coming. I'm in. I'm joining you. So the word pigiyah is not just to change, but it's to change in an assertive fashion. And especially when we're davening for Am Yisrael, and especially at this stage of history, I think that there's a voice of tefillah that borders on aggressive. When it comes to your own tefillah, what do I deserve? He pleads. Even Moshe Rabbeinu realizes he doesn't deserve everything, anything, and human being, as much as you have, you don't deserve whatever you're requesting from the Rebbeinu Shalom. But when you're davening for Am Yisrael, then already there's a whole different voice. I mentioned to you that in Mirtz Hashem, we're going to talk about Chassidus soon. One of the changes of Chassidus was that our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu is so intimate and so intense that when we speak to him on behalf of Am Yisrael's needs, you can speak in a way that borders on chutzpah. Remember we talked about the posture of tefillah? Did I talk with you about this? So you ever seen in some of the modern Israeli yeshivas where people are throwing their hands up to Shemayim, and maybe even in our yeshiva and talking to Hashem? Your grandparents would have a heart attack if they saw it. If you're all davening like this and talking to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because most of the posturing, which is classic, and Shulchan Aruch is very humble and meek and submissive. This is, seems to be like I'm talking to you or asking you to perform something. But it comes from Hasidic influences. And it comes from the sense that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's a beautiful story Rav Amital would always tell us. One year, the famous Rebbe Yitzchak of Berditchev, who we'll talk a little bit about, was a beautiful, beautiful chazan, really a famed, famed chazan. So one year, it was Tfilas Ne'ilah. And the sun was setting. And everyone's all tense, looking outside. They don't really have watches. Who knows if they had watches, but they're looking at the sunset. And he stops in the end of Tfilah. Quiet. He waits 5 minutes. Everyone's getting antsy. Doesn't finish. 10 minutes pass, 15 minutes pass. It's literally Shkia. They can see the sun setting. And he rifles off the end of the bracha. He mumbles the end, he finishes it all off. So they're gathering outside in the courtyard, outside of Matzei Yom Kippur. They say, Rebbe, was heistach? What happened? Like, what was happening? He says, well, I was davening and I saw that in Shemayim my tefillos were totally ineffective. They weren't getting anywhere. It was purposeless to offer another tefillah just for it to glance off of Shari Shemayim. It was great kitrug in Shemayim and I was unable to complete my tefillos. But then I remembered a trick we used to play on my mother. My mother used to have a cabinet which she kept all of her candy, when she would give it out to us when we deserved it, but very sparingly. So whenever my sisters and my brothers and I wanted some candy, we'd all assemble near the candy cabinet, and I would blurt out a bracha, Baruch atah Hashem, with Hashem, Hashem, Shehakol niyeh bidvaro. Then my mother was forced to give us candy, that it shouldn't be a bracha levatala. So I figured I'm going to play the same trick on the Rebbe Shlomo. I'm going to blurt out, Baruch atah Hashem, melech melcha v'solech levo, v'seinu v'almos v'yishua amavash v'seinu b'chol shana v'shana, Baruch atah Hashem, mekadesh amoyim, mekadesh yisrael v'yam ha-kippurim. Now that I've said a bracha that Hashem is mochel tam yisrael, now you have to be mochel us, because you don't want to be a bracha levatala. That's how you daven to Hashem, like you're playing a trick on your mother. That's how Levi Yitzchak davened. And we'll talk about this. And not just that story, but that's probably the most colorful story. So when you daven for yourself, you're very meek and humble, and what do you deserve? Somehow when you daven for Am Yisrael in general, and especially in this era, where I think, as I keep telling you, Am Yisrael in the end of history has passed two tests with flying colors. Which Baruch Hu tested our people twice. One is the Holocaust, would we be able to maintain our Emunah? And one is Midianas Yisrael, after all this time waiting to come back to Israel, expecting clouds of glory, international reception. Everyone's thrilled, and we did receive an international reception. It was through the barrel of a gun. And we showed such dedication and self-sacrifice to be back in this land. I think Am Yisrael has zechuyos that we should be davening for, and again, not in a way that's chutzpahdik, or God forbid, heretical, or blasphemous. You don't talk to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in certain ways. But to just say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I'm not just davening in a very difficult week. Much of you were spared from that week because you're living here in a lunch foot, but the South, people in the South had a very, very frightful week. I'm not just talking about how many casualties there were and injuries, but imagine getting up every night, and imagine little children panic-struck and terrified and sleeping in bunkers, and it's a very, very difficult week, and again, in the harder part, not the harder, but one of the difficult parts is that there's really no resolution. We're back basically where we started a week ago. In some ways, we've lost ground. So think about that when you daven, and Parshas Vayetze, when Yaakov has so much to daven for, we really have a lot to daven for, if not for in our own lives, but for Am Yisrael. Boys that you'll meet in Mirtz Hashem in a couple of weeks are still in the army serving, and obviously other boys, so. And one of the things I hope that being in yeshiva like this is able to broaden your horizons of Avodas Hashem, and that it's not just what happens in the Blat Gemara, but that we have to take part in protecting our people and serving our people. And if you're not going to be the one serving, at least you identify and realize that there's so much more. And I think if there's one way that I can describe life in Gush for you, it's, I think in many contexts, you're in yeshiva deepens your Avodas Hashem. More Gemara, more halacha, more davening, better midos, better chesed. I think we try to do that as well. But I would like to think that here we also stretch your avodas Hashem. It's not just deepening the areas that you were exposed to in high school, but it's stretching Avodas Hashem into areas that maybe you're not so exposed to when you're living back in Cedar Lane, Central Avenue, or whatever, Starro Drive, or areas of such. I also want to talk about the word makom. It's a very interesting phraseology that Hashem is described here as makom. It doesn't say, v'yifka b'Hashem, v'yifka b'Elokim, v'yifka b'Elokei Aviv Yitzchak, v'yifka b'makom. And Hashem is the makom shel olam. And what does it mean for Hashem to be the makom shel olam, and why is it used here? And how do we interpret that existentially for our lives, for our experiences? So I used to have a very hard time with this. I think people translate the word Makom HaShalom into that little children's song, Hashem is here, Hashem is there, Hashem is truly everywhere, and the permeating presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which of course is true, but it's harder to feel. I'm looking at a sefer, I'm not looking at HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence. Our world is dotted with human experiences. But I have to thank Google for helping me understand this medrash, or this interpretation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Because imagine you're sitting in a lone shvut, and you want to know where you are. So you look on Google, and you find yourself. And in theory, if Google's Zoom were magnified enough, you can actually see yourself sitting in this classroom in a lone shvut. Now let's say you zoomed out. So you'd see Gush Etzion. Let's say you zoomed out even more, you'd see Eretz Yisrael. You zoomed out even more, you'd see planet Earth. You zoomed out even more, you'd see the solar system. A little more the galaxy. A little more whatever. I'm not that good an astronomer. But you'd zoom out and zoom out and zoom out until you'd be able to see. And at some point, you wouldn't be able to zoom out anymore. You'd be at the end of the universe. The universe is very large, very expansive, but it's finite. So there's an end of the universe somewhere. It ends. And you'd zoom out, and you'd be at the end. If you zoomed out one more time, then you'd be in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Place is to us, or space is to us. We live in space. As HaKadosh Baruch Hu is to space. Just like we are contained by space, space is contained by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Makom Shel Olam. So just like we have Makom, we have our place. Place, or space, area, inheres within HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Because I'll talk about this in Parshas Vayetze, a beautiful medrash I recorded a shiur, if you want to listen to it early in the week, for Wayitar. That means that wherever you are, you try to feel HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence, not just that Hashem is here in this room, but that I'm contained by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Space and location is a very powerful feeling. We all feel that we're in the room. We all feel that we're in a particular location. And even in a general sense, if I know I'm in the same yeshiva as Danny, I may not, let's say I haven't seen you in many, many years, and I know you're in the same city. Okay, I may not be able to meet you, but at least it gives me a good feeling to know we're in the same city. We'll touch base. We'll tag each other. You know, we're both in Beijing or I don't know, something. You feel that you're in, space creates connectivity. That we're sharing the same space, we're sharing the same environment, we're sharing the same area. Even if it's not interpersonal and direct, that we're chavrusas, we're davening next to one another, sitting in the same car, we're on the same highway, tag in, check in where you are, tag in on your Facebook, where you happen to be. So that sense that wherever you are, you're in the space of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because the entire universe is the space of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is meant to give a certain connection to the Ribbono Shel Olam. And that's why the word makom is utilized specifically in Vayetze. Because Yaakov really doesn't have any location or place. He's been expelled from his family. He doesn't know where he'll end up. We know the end of Parshas Vayetze. Yaakov didn't. So this is a person who is struggling at all levels, physically, obviously, militarily, he's very vulnerable, but also he doesn't have any... What will his location be? What will his place be? And that's why the Torah describes that he's able to identify HaKadosh Baruch Hu as Makom Shel Olam, and particularly by being in the location on this earth that's most aligned with HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence in this universe, Shara Shemayim and Beis Elokim. And that's why I think the Torah intentionally confounds location. Where is Yaakov now? A little trick question. Where is Yaakov? Well, maybe. He's in Beit El? As far as I'm just playing around with you. As far as I know, he made it to Haran. Okay, well, maybe that just means that he was on his way to Haran, according to the literal pshat. According to Rashi, he walked backwards. Having arrived in Haran, he said, I passed by the... But, Tani, how could he be in Beit El if he's in Beis Elokim Mishar HaShemayim? That sounds like Yerushalayim to me. And if there's a place to have a ladder... I'm not picking on you, obviously. This is Rashi. If there's a place to have a ladder scanning the heavens, that's supposed to be in Yerushalayim. That's the Makom Makedah. So where is Yaakov? Is he in Haran? Is he in Beit El? Is he in Yerushalayim? Or is he somewhere on the way from Be'er Sheva, somewhere in the middle? So Rashi does the math for us. Essentially, according to Rashi, if you just want to have the Medrash's solution, he arrives in Haran, walks backward, he's on his way back to Yerushalayim, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu allows Yerushalayim to approach him, so Beit El and Yerushalayim become collapsed. The point is, whether it's the literal reading, Rashi's reading, all of location is being jumbled in Parshas Vayetzeh. There are no coordinates. It's all the coordinates fall upon one another. They're all the same. Beit El, Yerushalayim, Haran, tectonic plates are moving, Yerushalayim is moving towards Beit El, which essentially means because the Kodesh Baruch Hu is a Makomo. So if you have a more transcendent sense of space and you realize you're in the presence of a Kodesh Baruch Hu, then to an extent, the particular coordinates that you're inhabiting are less important. So it's a literary device to highlight a Kodesh Baruch Hu as a Makomo Shalolam. The fact that we don't really know where Yaakov is because he's in the Makom of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So I think one way to translate to experience is just to feel HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence. Another way to translate the experience, this is going to be a while because it's Friday, and I was going to solve that deep thing. Okay, we'll see. If he doesn't get solved in a moment, we'll relocate our place. Not our Parshas Vayetzeh, we'll find a new shiur room. Okay? The second issue, which I think is important, is Yaakov's longing this night is for Yerushalayim, and he knows he won't be in Yerushalayim, and he knows he'll spend 20 plus years, doesn't know how long, far from Yerushalayim, but he connects very deeply to a location. And I think one of the most stunning achievements of Am Yisrael over the last 2,000 years is maintaining that consciousness of Eretz Yisrael and Yerushalayim, despite being dislocated, despite being distant, despite being persecuted, and who would have thought, And again, I think that because you have so much and you can get on a plane and go to Israel and your parents could get on a plane and go to Israel, you speak to Ethiopian immigrants who walked months, if not years, through the sands of the desert to arrive in Israel, and they only knew one word. There's only one word on their tongues, and that was Yerushalayim. They only knew one word of Hebrew, but that was one word that was spoken about. It was like a code. What do they call this? A kill code or a safety word where you want the FBI to come into the room and save you when you say the following word. And so that was their word, Yerushalayim. And the ability to sense HaKadosh Baruch Hu's makom and to trace yourself back to the makom on this earth that his presence is felt most deeply, that's not just an experience that's important for davening and for connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's an experience that is important in terms of your Israel consciousness. And this is something we'll talk a lot about this year. Don't let anyone in this building or other buildings speak in a manner that I feel is morally repugnant and condescending, that if you don't live in Israel, your life's a waste. Conceptually, yes, every single Jew should live here, and historically, every single Jew will live here. Your grandchildren will live in this country at some point. That's a fact. And whoever's here is building your future. I'm here for you. One day when your grandchildren come, it's because of whatever efforts I and whoever else live here employ, it will be for you to come. And hopefully it will be out of choice, not out of distress. But unfortunately, we've seen that sometimes distress happens very quickly. As Jews in France, as Jews, of course, in Tunisia in 1967. And you'd be surprised how volatile the world is. You think the world is so secure and permanent, and Chalila v'chas, no one is wishing any turbulence on American Jewry. Those types of statements that people say sometimes, which I think are just absolutely horrific, that they wish that there's more anti-Semitism in America so that American Jews will have impetus and motive to come. Those disgusting comments, and anyone that issues that comment basically should be disqualified in your mind from having any validity or credibility in other conversations. So let no one equally tell you that if you don't live in Eretz Yisrael in 2018, you can't live a meaningful and deep life of an Oved Hashem. Life is complex. Life is multivariable. And many of you will come, many of you won't come. And I hope that most of you that don't come for good reasons. But one thing has to be clear, and I hope that's becoming clearer and clearer. And if it isn't, it's still a process. I know it happens sooner rather than later, that this is where we should be. And if you could just wave a wand, And for some people, wave a wand and eliminate all the obstacles. For some people, wave a wand and create greater desire. But this is where Jews are meant to live, and this is where Jews will live, and this is the epicenter of Jewish history, and this is where Jewish history will evolve into when the Beis HaMikdash. That sense of living a bifurcated life where you make peace with your world. You live in Teaneck, you live in Riverdale, you live in Los Angeles, you live in Five Towns, wherever you live, and you accept your reality, and you improve it, and you advance it, and you participate in it. But you never abdicate that sense that this is not where I should be. I belong elsewhere, I should be elsewhere at this stage of history, and it's hard. It's hard for people to have those two voices in their heads, because when you just accept your reality, you want it to be perfect, and you want to script that, and I think life in general, not just where you live, is about that very, very delicate scene between dreaming of a better you, but accepting the you that you are. Forget where you live. There's so many things I'd like to accomplish in this life of mine. And I don't know that I'll reach all of them. And I have to live with myself, with my imperfections, with my limitations, with what I don't feel I'm capable of. But I still want myself to be better. And I still dream and yearn for more. And that balance in life is so crucial, because if you don't have dreams and ambitions, then essentially you're saddled in mediocrity. But if you don't have acceptance, then you're always saddled with guilt and frustration and disappointment. And how do you, again, thread that needle between dreaming for more, but accepting within reasons what you have, not as perfect, but as what you'll roll with, your current reality, in yourself, in your relationships, in your workplace, in everything. And certainly in where you live. To know that you live in a certain location and you're going to excel there, and to be excel means you have to participate, and you have to vote, and you have to be a member of society. But to dream that there's a different makom, and to yishmon esrei and yishalayim ircha, in a very sincere way, not just to say, well, waiting for Mashiach, and one day he'll come, and but I want the Mets to win a World Series first before he comes. Like, in a, it's not just that trickery of your mind that when he'll come, when he won't come. It's sense that I was in Yerushalayim, I was in Gush, I was in Israel for a year, 2 years, whatever. That's my place. Right now, I may have to live my life elsewhere. And you're no different than anyone else. Like I said, I don't want you to feel that people living in Israel don't have to go through this challenge. I live in Israel. There are parts of my life I'd like to change. Some of it I will be able to, some of it I won't be able to. And I'm able, as best as I can, to try to find that balance. So the word makom is a very, very powerful description of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because it describes HaKadosh Baruch Hu as the makom wherever you are, and hopefully you have that sense of being in Hashem's makom, because wherever you are, you're zooming in from Hashem. And because there's a makom that Yaakov inhabited that night that I'm sure helped him through his 20-plus years in Laban's home to be able to survive. Okay, let's stop here. We'll learn a little bit about Kinyan Dalet Amos, talk a little bit about Titan MS Liakov, and then let's set a time. Unless something strange happens, unless, I don't know, Noam peppers me with questions, we'll finish at 10 o'clock, okay? How does that sound? 10 o'clock. That's a hard one. 10:05. Give me a little extra. 10:05. Trying to be a Rahman and a Revi all at once. Not a